Turn with me again, please, to Luke's Gospel and chapter 18. And our passage this morning, then, is verses 9 to 14 of this chapter. Now, one of Jesus' favourite techniques in telling his parables is contrast. And so there are some parables where contrast is at least involved. So whether it's between the Samaritan who stops and helps and the religious leaders who walk by on the other side, or whether it's between the father who is welcoming and the older brother who is bitter, or whether it's between the master who is merciful and the servant who is not. In these cases, contrast is one important component, one important element in the overall plot. But then there are other parables, aren't there, which are completely centred around a particular contrast. Whether then it's the contrast between a wise and a foolish builder, or the contrast between five wise virgins and five foolish virgins, or the contrast between four different types of soil. In these cases, the whole plot is a contrast. The whole plot revolves around a contrast. And the parable that we've come to this morning here in Luke 18, it falls into this second category. Not merely does it involve a contrast, but the whole plot centres upon a particular contrast. And in this case, then, it's the contrast between a self-righteous Pharisee on the one hand and a contrite tax collector on the other hand. And we're just going to spend a few minutes then looking at each of these characters in turn. So first of all, then, this morning, the self-righteous Pharisee. Now, in modern parlance, we would often use this word self-righteous without any particular religious or theological connotation. So we would use it then simply to describe someone's manner, someone's tone of voice perhaps, the way someone comes across. Toward the end of last year, the Institute for Public Policy Research produced a report on the way in which the general public perceives climate change. And the report concluded that on the whole, the general public is pretty fed up with the concept of climate change. And it said this then, it said, the public either views the government's stance on climate change as an excuse to increase taxes, or sees government decisions such as allowing airport expansions as hypocritical. And then this, they also resent being made to feel guilty about their lifestyle and dismiss environmentalists as smug and self-righteous. And that then is a fairly typical modern example of how this word is used. Someone who comes across as smug and sanctimonious and holier than thou, we might call self-righteous. But in referring this morning to this Pharisee as self-righteous, I mean more than that. I don't just mean that he's smug and sanctimonious and holier than thou in his manner, although that may be true. But I'm using the term in a decidedly religious and theological sense. By righteous, I'm referring to being right with God. And by self-righteous, then, I'm referring to assuming oneself to be right with God on the basis of one's own merits. That's what Luke is talking about in the opening words of this passage. Some who were confident of their own righteousness is literally, in the Greek, some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous. And it's that, then, it's that basing of one's ultimate status, one's ultimate security on the quality of one's own moral performance. It's that which this Pharisee in the parable exemplifies. And as we look out on our society today, there may be much self-righteousness about in that general, loose sense, the way in which the report on the environmentalists is using the term. There may be many who are self-righteous in the sense of being smug and sanctimonious and holier than thou in their tone. But I think that there are also many in our society today who are self-righteous in this deeper sense, this religious and theological sense. Many who believe, in some vague way at least, that there is a God. And who think that they have the approval of that God because of the way that they are living their lives. And you may be in that category this morning. For all I know, there may be someone here this morning who thinks that because of the way that they are living their lives, because of their moral performance, because of the decency, the respectability of their lives as a whole, they have God's approval. Well, having established then what we mean by self-righteous, let me just point out three things about this self-righteous Pharisee. Three things, if you like, which accompany his self-righteousness. First of all, he's man-centered. He's man-centered. So I mean by that then that he's man-centered rather than God-centered. He is manward in his basic orientation rather than Godward in his basic orientation. This comes across, I think, in the first part of verse 11. Notice there the way in which this Pharisee positions himself physically. Because that verse, I think, shouldn't read "the Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself." Rather, it should read "the Pharisee stood up by himself and prayed." He stood up by himself. He made sure, in other words, that he separated himself from the hoi polloi. He made sure that he distinguished himself from the ordinary common or garden worshippers in that building. Like theatre-goers in former days who would take a box at the theatre, not in order to afford themselves a better view of the stage, but in order to afford everyone else a better view of them. So this man has made sure that it's visible and recognizable to everyone in that temple that he is in a special class of his own. He has stood up by himself in his own little place where everybody will notice him. And bear in mind that we've been told in verse 10, two men went up to the temple to pray. Now, what do you immediately think of when you read that word temple? What is its most obvious significance? Surely the presence of God. Above all else, the temple was the dwelling place, the residence, the house of God. And you would have thought then, wouldn't you, that this Pharisee here, in the presence of God, you would have thought that in that context, it would have paled into insignificance, his geographical and spatial relationship to the other worshippers in that place. But no, for him it's a big deal. Because he's manward, he's man-centered in his orientation, and so he makes sure he stands up by himself, separate from everybody else. And then you move on to the second half of verse 11, and the actual content of this man's prayer. And he prays then, "God, I thank you that I am not like other men." Success is a very relative term, isn't it? So you might have two different football clubs in the Premier League which would assess and gauge success by quite different criteria. So for Chelsea, a successful season means coming first, coming top, being crowned as champions. For Stoke City, on the other hand, a successful season means avoiding relegation and securing a respectable mid-table position. Success is a very relative term. And you see, this man here, this Pharisee, he had a particular criterion by which he gauged his moral success. And that criterion was what other people around him were doing. So you see, he would read the court news in the local paper. And he would sometimes wander into the seediest areas of town on a Friday night and observe how other people were behaving. And he would listen to the couple in the house next door to him arguing and fighting and brawling. And the man coming late at night drunk. And he would see how people around him were behaving, and that was his criterion by which he gauged his own moral success. I thank you that I am not like other men. And so you see what I'm saying then? That as we watch how this Pharisee positions himself spatially, physically in that temple, and as we listen to how this Pharisee prays, there's this unmistakable emphasis, isn't there, on his man-centeredness. It's man that figures most prominently in his thinking, not God. And I don't think that's any coincidence. I think that self-righteousness and man-centeredness always go together. If you like, man-centeredness is the soil out of which self-righteousousness grows. Because you see, if you are truly God-centered in your orientation, if you are truly absorbed with the reality and the character of God, if you can truly sing, as we sang, how wonderful, how beautiful the sight of thee must be, thine endless wisdom, boundless power, and awful purity, then you cannot be self-righteous. You cannot rest assured in your own moral virtue. It's impossible. And if you then this morning are someone who is resting assured in your own moral virtue, then let me suggest to you that the God you believe in is too small. You need to read the Bible. You need to reckon with this God who reveals himself in this book. You need to get an eyeful of him. And you need then to understand how immense and holy, as we considered in our opening prayer, this God is. You need to allow yourself to be overwhelmed and dwarfed and belittled by the sheer immensity of the God of the Bible. That's your greatest need this morning, if you're one of these people who has great confidence in your own moral performance. You need to see God for who he is. That was this Pharisee's greatest need, and perhaps it's your need this morning. So that's the first thing about him. He's man-centered. But then secondly, he's hypocritical. He's hypocritical. Because his prayer continues then, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, but evildoers is far too vague a translation. It should really be something like abusers and deniers of justice. Abusers and deniers of justice. Adulterers, robbers, abusers and deniers of justice. Adulterers. And I think that as we read that, we're supposed to hear bells ringing in our minds. Because already in Luke's gospel, these very people, the Pharisees themselves no less, have been labelled as these very things which he mentions here in his prayer. The Pharisees have been labelled robbers. You go back to chapter 11 and verse 39, Jesus' words there. Now then, you Pharisees, clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. Jesus accusing them there of being rapacious, greedy, wicked, robbing. And then again, these Pharisees have been labelled abusers and deniers of justice. You carry on in chapter 11, verse 42. Woe to you Pharisees, because you give God a tenth of your mint, rue, and all other kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice. And then similarly, they've been accused of adultery, haven't they? You think of back in chapter 16, And verse 18, Jesus' words there, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery. And the man who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Words which are specifically addressed to these Pharisees for whom multiple divorces were such a common and standard practice. And so you see what I'm saying then, that this man is a Pharisee. And he's thanking God that he's not like robbers, unjust men, adulterers. And yet, already just in these very recent chapters of Luke's Gospel, the Pharisees have been labelled as precisely those three things. In other words then, his claim to be living a life free of robbery, and free of injustice, and free of adultery, that claim has been discredited and contradicted already by Jesus' words elsewhere. And again, I think this is always inevitably a hallmark of self-righteousness. If this morning we are pinning our hopes on our own moral performance, on our ability to have stayed free from certain vices, then like the Pharisee, we are hypocritical. Because we haven't. We haven't stayed free of those vices. Perhaps this morning you think, well, I'm no adulterer. I've been faithful to my marriage partner for all these years. I'm no adulterer. But what about Jesus' words there in Matthew 5:28? I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Perhaps this morning you'll be very adamant, I'm no murderer. Oh no, I've never taken anybody's life. What about Jesus' words in Matthew 5:22? I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother, and this is in the context of murder, he says this, will be subject to judgment. Perhaps this morning you're saying, oh, I'm certainly no idolater. I've always gone to church. I've never been a Muslim. I've never been a Hindu. I've never worshipped in another religion. I'm no idolater. What about Jesus' penetrating words in Matthew 6:24? No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. And I'm saying then that if we're pinning our hopes on our own moral performance, we're hypocrites. Because none of us has lived up to those penetrating demands of God's law, God's word. And we need to recognize then how spurious our claims to moral righteousness and moral rectitude are. How false, how unsustainable, how hypocritical. This Pharisee was not only man-centered, he was a hypocrite. But then, thirdly, he's pathetic. He's pathetic. Because his prayer then continues, I thank you, I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. Even like this tax collector. If you've ever visited my hometown, Thirsk, then you might have been struck by what a small and uneventful kind of place it is. You might not think that the fire brigade in Thirsk would have much to do with themselves. But in actual fact, you'd be wrong, because Thirsk is quite near the A1, the motorway. There's a lot of accidents on there, and the fire engines in Thirsk quite routinely get called out to those accidents. And I know a lady who lives on the main road between Thirsk and the A1. And there was one instance a few years ago, one afternoon, and she heard a fire engine whizzing past. It wasn't, as I say, an uncommon sound for her living on that particular route. And she heard it whizzing past her door. And she was on the phone at that point, and she actually uttered the words to the person on the other end of the phone, some poor soul on the A1. What she didn't realise was that fire engine wasn't bound for an accident on the A1. It was bound for a head-on collision just about half a mile up the road, a head-on collision which involved her husband on his way home from work. And you see, then there she was, and she was feeling sorry for some poor soul on the A1. Whereas in actual fact, those poor souls on the A1 were fine. There was no accident there. They were fine. She should have felt sorry for herself. It was her own husband who had been caught up in an accident, although happily he was fine after a few days. And there's a similar kind of irony here. That here's this man, And he's thanking God that he's not like the tax collector. And the irony is, of course, that tax collector, he's fine. He's in a great position. We read in verse 14, he's justified. He's accepted by God. He's God's friend. He's reconciled to the living God. He's at peace with God. God accepts him and welcomes him as his own child and friend. The tax collector's fine. And actually, the one who has the problems is the man, is this man himself. He's the one whom we read in verse 14 isn't justified, isn't God's friend, isn't reconciled. He's still alienated from God. And here he is then thanking God he's not like the tax collector. Actually, his biggest problem is that he isn't like the tax collector. Because if he was like the tax collector, he would be justified as well. But he's not. And here he is then, this pathetic man thanking God that he's not like the tax collector who is justified before God. Perhaps this morning, again, you're someone who has very high morals. And perhaps you know some people, some Christians, some people who are really into Jesus. They're always talking about Jesus. But you actually look down on those people with some disdain. Because they are actually not as refined in their morals and their behaviour as you are. They've had a past, perhaps, of drunkenness, a past of swearing a lot. And although, yes, when they became Christians and they started getting into this Jesus stuff, they changed and they're different now, still they struggle sometimes with their old habits and with their old vices and with their old tendencies. Whereas you're very refined. You never go down that kind of route. You're very refined and moral. And so you're glad that you're not them. I'm glad I'm not like that person. I'm so much more refined than that person. And it's the same irony as here. That person's fine. Because that person's believing in Jesus. That person's justified before God. And it's you who is still basing everything upon your own morals and your own performance. It's you who's in the dire need. It's you who's in the dire straits. And so here's this Pharisee then. And he's self-righteous. All his hopes are pinned on what he has done, his achievements. And I'm saying then that these are three characteristics of him. He's man-centered, he's hypocritical, and he's pathetic ultimately. But then let's just move on in the last few minutes to the contrite tax collector. The contrite tax collector. And you might be wondering why, earlier on in the service, I read that passage from Leviticus chapter 16. But the reason is that I think it's actually, in some ways, the background, the backdrop to this tax collector that we encounter here in Luke 18. There in Luke 16, we read that passage about the Day of Atonement, didn't we? The Day of Atonement was, of course, the foremost, the central festival in the Old Testament calendar. And there were two vital components. There were, amongst others, two vital elements in that Day of Atonement. One was afflicting oneself. Now that wasn't mentioned in Leviticus 16, but it's mentioned in chapter 23 and verse 29. One vital component on the Day of Atonement was that the Jews had to afflict themselves. That means fast, basically. They had to make themselves suffer that day by fasting. And it's put very seriously there in chapter 23, verse 29. If someone didn't afflict themselves, they would be cut off from their people. So that was an important component, afflicting themselves on the Day of Atonement. And of course, that signified contrition. Heart contrition, the outward afflicting of oneself by fasting was a symbol of the inward heart contrition. So it signified contrition. That was one important element. And then another vital component, of course, was the blood. The way the priest then on this day was allowed into the most holy place behind the curtain. And he would there sprinkle blood on various items of the temple furnishings and supremely, of course, and most importantly, upon that thing, that object called the atonement cover, or in the more traditional versions, the mercy seat. And that then signified atonement. It signified sin being covered, God's anger being removed. So I'm saying there were those two vital components on the Day of Atonement. There was the afflicting of oneself, and that signified contrition. And there was the sprinkling of the blood, and that signified atonement and sin being dealt with. And at the heart of Israel's religion then, there was this profound connection between these two things, between heart contrition and atonement for sin. And I think that you see that. You see these two components coming out in the conduct of this tax collector here in the second half of our passage. First of all, then, you see very much, don't you, him afflicting himself. The tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast. There's that afflicting of himself. There's that self-flagellation almost. He doesn't perhaps literally fast, but there's the equivalent actions to fasting. There are these visible, physical tokens of contrition in this man's conduct. So there's contrition there. And then on the other hand, secondly, there's an emphasis on atonement, because it's very interesting, and this is what I think legitimizes us seeing Leviticus 16 as the basis for this passage. There's a very interesting phrase in verse 13. He cries out, "God, have mercy on me." But the word he uses there in the Greek is the same word, exactly the same word, as you have in Leviticus 16 in the Greek version for the mercy seat, the atonement cover. "God, have mercy on me." It's literally, "God, atone for me. God, cover my sin. God, remove your anger." It's that exact same word that he uses. And so I think this is really, in a way, the supreme irony of this passage. On the one hand, you have this Pharisee, and he's a Jew, and he's devout, and he's religious. And he is so impressively part of the religious establishment. And yet, with him, there's none of this. There's none of this contrition. He's just boasting about all his moral purity. And there's none of this appeal for atonement. Nothing of that. No cry for God to cover his sin. Yet on the other hand, you have this irreligious tax collector who probably had never celebrated the Day of Atonement in his life. And yet he is contrite. And he is appealing for atonement for his sins to be covered. And it's him that goes home justified. Because this passage is saying this is the way to be made right with God. The way to be made right with God is through this combination of contrition and atonement. Through coming to God contritely and asking for atonement through a sacrifice. Boasting of how well you've lived and performed. That's not the way to God. This man tried that and he went away unjustified. He went away alienated from God. God wasn't interested in his boast. God didn't care for all his list of achievements. But this other man who came contritely and who pleaded for atonement, he went home justified. And it's the same for us this morning then. That we need to abandon our pride. We need to abandon all our claims to have lived well and purely and satisfactorily, because those claims just won't live up to God's scrutiny. And instead, we need to come this humble way. We need to recognize how sinful we are, come contritely, and plead for that atonement, which ultimately, of course, is not through the blood of a goat, as in Leviticus 16. But it's through the blood of Jesus, God's own Son. And so I close asking you whether you've come to God that way. Perhaps this morning you're still trying to come to God the other way. You'll get nowhere. You'll get no further than this Pharisee did. It's vain. It's hopeless. It's useless. I urge you to come to God through this very humbling way. It's painful. It's not nice to have to face up to what a wretch you are. But that's the way to God. Coming humbly and contritely, but pleading that atonement, that covering for sin, which has come through his Son's blood. Many of us in this room have done that. And I urge you all this morning to make sure you're in that category. Amen.